everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into Advertising Week's Great Minds, People and Culture podcast. I'm your host, Brenna Kinsey, Executive Vice President of Advertising Week and Emerald. On this episode, we're speaking to Christine Guilfoyle. Chris is the president of the Association of National Advertisers, CHER, the global collective of over 7,200 brands committed to the accurate representation of women in marketing, media, and entertainment. With over 20 plus years of experience, Christine has championed the progress of gender equity both in front of and behind the camera. Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Ren. It's absolutely my pleasure. It's such a delight to be with you.
I'm super excited to talk to you about what it means to have a seat at the table. I know that's something that you're very passionate about. Before we start, I would love for you to define for us in your perspective what having a seat at the table means to you personally.
Ren, what I want to say is that I didn't realize what having a seat at the table or what a seat at the table meant until very late in my career. I'd say for 25 years, I had a seat behind the seat at the table and was perfectly content in being that parent over shoulder, if you will, whispering into the ear, usually of a gentleman who had that seat at the table. And recently, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, I recognized that I didn't need to be the whisperer, if you will, that having my own seat, advocating with my own voice, and for those that were kind of whispering behind me, was incredibly important to drive the agenda that gets set at the table.
So that's interesting. Was that because you didn't care about being that voice and you were okay with being the whisperer and doing the work to help the decision makers? Or was it because you were given titles that seemed like you would have a seat at the table, but that seat was not essentially created for you?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. You know, first of all, I don't think the world in which we all work is, you know, one big dining room table with lots and lots of seats. I think it's more like a stacking table. So in businesses that I managed myself, I ran those businesses with my team where everyone had a seat at that table. It was much more of a community table, if you will. But then as you ladder up into senior leadership or even into the influencing of your board of directors, those layers of seats become very nuanced. And as you said in your question, for the bulk of my career, you know, look, I had my head down and I was doing the work. And I felt that that should have been enough. And what I came to realize is that it's two different work streams, really. Doing the work and then making sure that you have that voice to advocate not only for yourself, but also for the team of people that got that work accomplished at the main table.
And you refer to a point in time where your perspective about all of this changed. So was there a pivotal moment in your career that made you realize the importance of having a seat at the table?
Yes, I think that it comes with age, perspective, your ability to continue to deliver when you are a high performer with an organization and or you are continually sought out for the shaping of strategy and driving forth the agenda. At first, you're incredibly grateful, like you're flattered. You've been invited into the tent. And I think that you quickly recognize that being at the tent doesn't put you at the table. And as you become more confident and you see how these dynamics play out, you recognize that in the translation, how you would emphasize, how you would support, how you would articulate can get fuzzy if you're not actually the person sitting there and communicating those findings, those ideas, that marketplace intel, your revenue deliverables, you know, whatever it is that your business happens to be focused on. Once I recognized that, you know, the table needed to have more people in the seats that looked like me and had the depth of experience that I had, that's when it was the aha of like, I gotta get to that table. I don't wanna be in the snack tray in the family room, if you will. Keeping the analogy going, Ren.
Yeah, I really appreciate that perspective. Do you think most people hold off on basically demanding that seat at the table because they're afraid of conflict or afraid of any type of confrontation that is actually part of being at the seat of the table. You have to be comfortable with disagreeing with your colleagues and being disagreed on based on your point of view too.
Yeah, I think that every organization is different, right? And the management styles. But in the bulk of the organizations that I have had the pleasure, and I truly mean that genuinely, had the pleasure to work within, as you move up, it gets more and more narrow. And I think that's what causes people to hesitate to claim the seat that is rightfully theirs for two reasons. First, you don't want to claim and end up in, as you move up funnel, to no longer be within the organization. But I also think that you weigh your reward risk. Now, when I'm here at the table, place that I've fought and used my voice to get, are you prepared to fully show up and be as honest, as transparent, and as you said, sometimes in conflict with others that are at the table and may have been there for quite some time. So I think it's it's like the confidence to get there, but then it's the confidence and the know-how to have your voice heard so you can stay there.
And when you do get there, how do you maintain authenticity while holding on to a position of influence and authority?
Listen, I think that comes to like who it is that you are and where does your authenticity meter start and end. Very early on in my career, I recognized that to be honest, ethical, and true were guiding principles for me. Different people have different guiding principles. I've not ever been put in a position where I didn't feel like I couldn't be honest, ethical, and true. Although there were times that I was less forceful about the way in which I delivered that information. And I think you have to be able to read the tone and understand what your contribution is at that particular time. But I have seen people who adjust from who it is that they are, because ultimately they feel like they need to behave in a certain way in order to stay.
Which is essentially people pleasing. When I think of authenticity, if people don't have authenticity and they're people pleasing, that's one extreme. And then the other one that you touched on, which is not being able to read the room or know your audience to get the message across or get the approval you need just because you're trying to stay authentic to who you are.
Yeah. And you know what? Here's the thing. We all have to learn on a scale of 1 to 10, consensus building. Checking your ego at the door, right? It's like understanding where you have goals and needs from those around the table. When do you push and when do you hold back? And how do you champion others at the table, understanding that they come with those same set of circumstances?
100%, I agree with you. You mentioned being important that someone that looked like you was in the room, and that's being a woman in an executive position. Can you recall a specific instance where your perspective as a woman brought unique value to a decision-making process that otherwise wouldn't have had that value had you not been included?
Yeah. And listen, I have to tell you, I am all for male allies, and I've had the great privilege in my career to have more allies, you know, just because of the nature of the organizations that I worked, than I had female mentorship. I think everyone has their secret sauce or, you know, their superpower, if you will. And I think when I realized that my male management team was coming to me because they didn't have a pulse on the people. They knew how to deliver their message, you know, whether that message was to the board, to the industry, to the street, to the employees, but they weren't getting the pulse back on how that messaging was received. People didn't feel like they could be honest and transparent internally, and externally, they didn't have the relationships in the market. So I served that connector superpower standpoint to be able to come back to them and say, in this particular instance, people sitting in the room wondered what company you were talking about because they didn't feel like it was the company that they worked in. That was like in an all-employee meeting. And then in the market, it's the same. Like your executives have come in. Do they recognize the market doesn't work that way anymore? Or those aren't the types of things that we're looking for from partners. And having that ability to build relationships where people felt that what they said was going to be confidential, that I was going to listen and probe them to really get it to, you know, what was the critique or the takeaway, and then be able to translate that back to senior management so they could make that actionable, because those people would not have said it to them.
And obviously that's a lot of effort on your part in building those relationships and building trust. And how do you approach that? What does your process look like in getting to know people, getting them to trust you, and essentially offering a safe space for them where you're getting the information that other people may not have access to?
I think always have an open door policy to be authentic, positive, and upbeat kind of every day, not just like 2 days before the meeting. And to demonstrate, I think it starts first with your team. Do they feel safe? Do they feel trusted? Do they feel that the environment is one in which they could be open in both in private and in public? And listen, people talk about those things, right? So then they tell their friends and so on and so forth. And you build up this reputation, either to the good or to the negative, you know, in being someone that could be sought out for this type of sharing.
And how can organizations foster an inclusive environment that ensures that these voices are constantly represented at the highest levels?
I actually think that organizations have done a very good job. Again, in the trajectory of my career, there was no such thing as employee resource groups, mentorship, and sponsorship programs. So I would say that I think organizations have done a really good job in putting those groups into practice and creating safe spaces within those groups for people to share and even to cross-pollinate between different groups so that it's not so siloed in the discussions that can come forth and be shared with senior management. I also think there's reverse mentorship programs, you know, when people are actively taking a role in the being a sponsor of an employee and bringing folks around. But I do think the pandemic and not being in the office as much as we did before, I think some of that is you learn who you can trust, what people's guiding principles are by watching them behave in interactions that aren't with you. I think that organizations are probably going to figure out like those skills that you pick up, particularly if you are in the early stages of your career, you know, watching, listening, modeling. I think that it's harder to do that when you're in the office less and or you're never necessarily in the office at the same time as your peers and or senior management. So I don't know what the solution to that is, because listen, I don't want to be the person that says, let's go to the office 5 days a week. I absolutely am enjoying the flexibility, but I do think that piece of watching and listening is missing in the new hybrid experience.
I think the data actually agrees with you. I've been reading a lot about this topic, and I read an article recently that said people who are in full remote environments or not closer to satellite offices are actually getting promoted less than their counterparts who are getting that visibility. And I don't know how much of that is really the bias of having someone close to you versus, to your point, them having much more tools to their disposal through working in person or watching in person their mentors or people that they look up to outside of an informal mentorship program.
I agree. And listen, I also think in that watching, that listening and modeling, you learn as much about what not to do as you do what to do. I will tell you, like in my career, those were some of the best lessons of how not to behave.
I agree with you. And you mentioned that you had a lot of male allies and mentors in your career. And I feel the same way. This was something I was actually thinking about yesterday. My first mentor was later on in my career in a senior director capacity. And he was a male executive and he really mentored me. And I felt like he was giving me a seat at the table and was my ally. And then after that, I had lots of different male colleagues, bosses that have continued to be mentors and allies for me. So I totally agree with you. The value of mentorship. How do you think people who don't have formal mentorships in place at their companies, how do you think they should approach getting that mentor, whether that is their boss or somebody else in the organization that could really help them?
I think that's a great question. You know, I'm sitting here thinking, like, how the heck did I do that? I would say that how I came across these people, it was almost by accident, right? You know, it was ultimately they had a need and they needed that need to be fulfilled. And in someone who loved to get the work done, you know, and I do really enjoy to get the work done. I have to say, I got tapped because they needed to get the work done. When you start to prove yourself that you're able to get the work done, I think there's this opportunity to get tapped. I'm not sure, though, that I would consider those gentlemen who did that my mentor. I think that that's something different. Like, I think that that's work and role fulfillment, which, listen, was fantastic for me. I think mentor is someone, I think it can be your immediate boss, but I think it's somebody who's wise and has wisdom and can see the big picture and understands where you may fit into that and offers you time and guidance and access in a variety of ways, right? You know, having a cup of coffee to answer your questions, but also to make suggestions to you on how you can put yourself out there or who are other people within the organization that they think you should meet. In my mind, at least, to me, a mentor isn't somebody who necessarily gets to cross something off their list by being good to me because I'm going to get it done. It's someone who sees that I want to get it done and goes out of their way to help me do it, maybe easier or more efficiently, or for me to get more credit for having done it at all.
I totally agree with you. I think part of being a good mentor is if it's value alignment for you and you have a sense of purpose and essentially job satisfaction by being a mentor, by elevating people, by being an ally to them. And it's not really something that you could learn to do to check off a box.
Correct. You know, it's so interesting because as I'm sitting here, Ren, and I so appreciate the conversation because, you know, it makes you really think far deeper about a topic that maybe you know, hadn't explored just because it's been a while. I don't feel that I had as many mentors as I would have liked. But I think that that actually caused me to be focused on being a mentor. As I sit in the chair that I'm in, and I think of all of the wonderful people who I gave their first job to, and then was able to help them get promoted, you know, move to other places in the organization to get experience, and then was able to hire them back at a more senior level. I think of the number of parents of young people that I've met, weddings that I've gone to, you know, Christmas cards with their babies on them. Like, that's for me where I know that I did right by them. Right? Because I became part of their life and they part of mine. And for me, that's how I would personally, you know, define it, because again, it aligns with who it is that I am. Others would define it in a different way. But there is great pride and joy in watching young people enter the workforce and being able to stay connected to them as they go on their career journey.
I love that. That's so beautiful. When you think about advocating for someone else to have a seat at the table, is there a story that comes to mind that you'd want to share and a positive impact that it had?
Sure. It's so funny. It is absolutely far easier for me to advocate, dare I say, you know, fight and argue on behalf of someone than it is for me to do it for myself. And I had a young woman who I actually brought with me from one organization to the other. You know, she was, you know, an administrative assistant within a sales organization, and she wanted to move into sales. And the company that we had moved to did not have any opportunity for anyone to move out of sales assist into being a salesperson. I tried to advocate for her and no one was listening. So one day she got a call. It was a summer Friday. And she and I switched clothes because she was dressed more casually. So we switched our outfit so she could go on the interview. And I was her reference and reached out directly and basically said, you know, it's your lucky day because I can't offer her this. So please hire her. They did. And then I subsequently later, you know, hired her back, which... it was so funny, the switching of clothes.
There's an element of selflessness that's built into the story that you shared, right? Like, you're not only passionate about helping people that work for you or your organization, but you're also passionate about building the bridge between somebody and another organization.
Yeah. Listen, it's a small business that we work in. As big and as broad as it has become, it's still small. And look, I have two daughters. I would want people to do the same for them, but also understand that this particular young woman, she deserved it, right? Like, she had put in all of the work, done all of the right things, had mastered her role, had taken on other responsibilities. She had done all the work. It really was not hard for me to advocate for her because she had done that. And, you know, I would say for people who are listening, you should ask yourself that, like, have you done the work that makes it easy for someone to be your advocate?
I love that. And, you know, you and I both mentioned that we didn't always have people like you advocating for us throughout our career. What would you suggest on the areas of self-advocacy and ensuring that on a personal level, someone who may not have somebody advocating, an ally or a mentor for them, how can they make sure that their contributions are recognized and acknowledged at the leadership level?
You know, Ren, it is something that I still struggle with, right? Because again, I think that, you know, I talked a little bit before about ego and how we all have them, but how do you keep that ego in check? I think women as a whole are accused of being emotional. So how do you sit in a very calm, cool, and unemotional way and assess how you can be an advocate for yourself? And who should the audience be for you to do that? I've been called emotional throughout my career. And frankly, as much as I try to check it, I'm very passionate about what it is that I do, how it is that I lean in, and the people who I surround myself with. So I want to cast off what I just said to you about not being emotional, because sometimes it's at the heart of who you are. I think when you are advocating for yourself, you have to look at your talk track in the same way that you would look at any business-focused talk track and make sure it is as bulletproof as a pitch to a client or a strategic plan, and put that same level of investment into creating your narrative so that you can tell it as you would in creating the narrative for the organization so that you can sell on their behalf.
You mentioned being emotional, and I was just thinking about what you shared with me earlier. I think you being emotional is probably the reason why people trust you and why your team is feeling safe enough to share things with you, because they see a level of authenticity in your passion through your emotions.
Well, thank you for that. Listen, again, I think it's hard to not be who it is that you are, but I think you have to kind of harness it appropriately so that you don't disappoint yourself and, of course, your team.
Exactly. I think to your point, harnessing it appropriately so that it's not taking away from your energy and that you are able to not take things personally or have so much emotions attached to the outcome that you're not able to move on from it.
I do think I take things personally. I think it's letting it go, right? It's like, if you don't get what it is that you want or what it is that you think you need or the people on your team need, I think you have to kind of pout it out, if you will, and then let it go and then figure out the next strategy for going back in.
And what tips do you have for yourself in letting it go? Do you have like a timeline that you hold yourself to letting something go?
Listen, I think sometimes, you know, it's like, I'd love to say it's a timeline, but I think it depends on how passionate you were about the topic, how invested you were in. I mean, I think that there are some things that even though I've let it go externally, I still kind of carry that boulder around in my backpack, if you will. I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that it's business and it's not personal. And that even though you may be disappointed that you didn't get what you want as it related to your mobility or your sales, or going back to how we started, your seat at the table, it's like, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again and reframe that narrative. And sometimes holding on to that personal inside quietly is a good motivator to kind of getting it right the next time.
That's a great tip. I love that. And as we wrap up, Are there any key tips you'd offer to our listeners on how to proactively seek a seat at the table, or if they have a seat at the table, advocate for others to do the same?
If you are a favored person in your organization, know that you have a responsibility to bring other people along with you, because if there are not differences of opinion at that table, eventually there has to be in order for that table to be correct. So be welcoming, be supportive, do unto others as you would hope that they do for you. And remember, you meet the same people going up as you do going down, and stay aligned to your principles.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and insights with us, Chris. I really appreciate your time.
Ren, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to think about all of these things that sometimes you put on a shelf somewhere and don't realize just how happy it makes you feel in your career to have these opportunities. So I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.